Do you have an opening theme song?
Yeah. All right, hey, I guess we're recording here. All right, hey everybody, welcome to episode one of Somebody's Blues. I'm your host, Eric McKelvin. I'm the festival director for the New York State Blues Festival, and this new podcast series is setting out to explore the history of blues in Central New York region and beyond, and in general to have an open and diverse conversation about this great American art form. Joining me today is Todd Fitzsimmons, a man who has worn many hats in our local scene as a musician, festival director, and independent promoter. Hi, Todd. Thank you so much for being here, the first guest on our on Somebody's Blues.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Such an honor. Thanks.
Yeah, cool. So let's start off. You know, one of the things we're doing with this is we want to give people, you know, a lot of people, you know, the scene's gone on so long in Central New York now, that, you know, there are younger generations. They're not really sure why Central New York is a blues place and, you know, how that all got started. And so give us a little bit of your background. Tell us some of the bands that you played in over the years and stuff like that.
Well, I came into the blues kind of through the front door, as they say. I got into the Allman Brothers and Little Feat, and Leonard Skinner and Southern Rock, and what I heard in that music was blues. That's what I liked, but I didn't know it. And nobody really pointed it out to me. It took me quite a few years playing. And I started out with Harvest. I was 17 and I got lucky and I got in that band. They'd been around a long time, had a bus, were busy touring. And I went from a rehearsal to the stage really quick. And that was my first couple years of playing live music. And then I moved to Florida, moved around, and I ran into a guy at a biker fisherman bar. I was parking cars down the road, and I'd get done at midnight. I'd still have my car parking uniform on, which was a pith helmet and, you know, the whole jungle thing with the brown knee-high socks and the boat shoes. And the only place they had live music was this biker fisherman bar down in Anna Marie Island. And I go in there and everybody look at me like, does this guy want to get killed or what? But I'd done enough time in those kind of places with Harvest that I'd gotten over that fear of getting my ass kicked, you know, by being the goofy kid. And I just wanted to hear the music. And they had a band there, and this guy used to get up and sit in with harmonica, and then he'd go around with his jug and for tips. And he'd sit in two or three songs a night. And his name was Tom Townsley. And I found out he was from Syracuse, and he had lived in Syracuse. So I befriended Tom. And every night when I get done with parking cars, I'd head down to that biker fisherman bar and party with Tom. It'd close. Party was always back at his house because his roommate was a pretty popular guy, you might say. And we had a hell of a scene. And really, that was where I discovered blues. Tom had a Robert Johnson record, and about 4 or 5 a.m., sipping on Jim Beam, he put that on. And we both were just like, you know, you could feel the ghost flying and the, you know, we got the whole effect of Robert Johnson. It's got to happen at 4 a.m. It has to involve Jim Beam. And that's where you get, that's where you sell your soul. And we started going up to Tampa to a blues jam up there. And, hosted by Rock Bottom and Sarasota Slim at the Peanut Gallery. I had a little MGB convertible. We'd hope we could get there and back in it without it breaking down. And we'd head up to this blues jam every Monday night. And we were great friends. And I moved away, and a couple of years went by, and I moved back to Syracuse. I went in a music store, and I was trying to find Tom because I'd heard he'd moved back to Syracuse. And I went in the bebop shop, and their sound man, Cold Shots blues band Tom was playing with, their sound man, Mike Conkle, was at the store that day. And I said I was looking for Tom, and he knew how to get hold of him. He said, yeah, well, their guitar player quit last night. Rehearsal, they got in a fight. They're looking for a guitar player. And I'm like, oh, no shit. So next thing you know, I'm in the Cold Shot blues band. And when I go to the first rehearsal, the drummer, here's my buddy from high school, Tom Parker. We've been in rock bands and things, and I'd known him, Tom, for a long time. He was just an ace drummer, later toured with Carrie Bell, and but he was in the band. And that was really some of my first introduction to the blues scene and playing blues in Syracuse. I called Tom and told him I was in town. He said, "Hey, I'm going to a little jam tonight, and you want to come?" And it was right next door to Shifty's. It was a laundromat. At night, they let them use it to jam. And Mike Petroff and Phil Petroff were there, and they were too young to get into bars. So they were just jamming at this laundromat at night.
So what year is this?
And this is 84, I would say 85 maybe.
Cool.
And so when I got there, Kyle Shirley comes up to me. He doesn't know me. "Who are you?" "Oh, I'm going to meet Tom." "You like blues?" "Yeah, I like blues." You want to play?" And I'm like, "Yeah, man, I'd love to play." And I said, "I'm not really a blues player. I'm just learning." He says, "Oh, that's all right. We all are, you know." And I was a little intimidated. I had played my whole life, but there was a lot more to playing blues than just knowing how to play guitar, you know. I didn't want to be another rock guy coming in. Yeah. You know, I was worried about that. I was trying to force myself not to play any Phrygian modes or try to use my chops. I was trying to, you know, be a blues guy. And I had sat in with that Biker Fisherman bar with a guy, and we were doing a song, and I ripped out, this Albert Lee solo that I'd learned. It had all these fancy notes. And I thought, well, this will impress him. When I got done, he had this flying V, and he reached down, he put it on a treble pickup and kicked it up on 10 and stung one note and blew my ass so far off of that fucking stage that for the rest of my life, I was like, how the hell did that happen? What was that? What was that energy? What was that thing that he had? He played very few notes, but man, they just cut right through. And that was the blues. And it was that element that I began searching out in music and playing. But that had led to the Cold Shot Blues Band. That was really my first exposure, and it became a full-time job. And Tom and I became roommates, and we spent probably 4 or 5 years full-time promoting the band, trying to bring blues to... See, at that time, the blues scene was just emerging. The Kingsnakes had really opened that door for everybody. Kingsnakes had released She's Tough and was getting tons of radio airplay. And everybody loved this music. And so we were kind of riding in on their heels at that time. It was a wonderful thing because people were open to it. And I was full-time on the phone trying to book the band all over the state, trying to earn a living, you know, keep us busy 5 nights a week. And I began promoting shows, doing other things to try to help us. I would promote a show, we would open, that would expose us to a big crowd, and the bar owner would then give us other gigs. And it would kind of, that's how we were breaking open new markets. And Tom and I had gone to the Chicago Blues Fest 1 year, and I'd snuck backstage and gotten Pine Top's phone number and Jimmy Rogers' phone number, and they weren't doing anything at the time. And I asked them if they'd like to play with us. If I flew them out, bought them a plane ticket, you know, I could give them a few $100 every night, and they said, yeah. And so awesome. Next thing you know, we had these legends of the blues flying into town, and we were backing them up. And I would book gigs from Albany to Rochester, out Buffalo. I'd try to put 4 or 5 gigs together. And best thing I ever did, because those times I spent, you know, concierge for Jimmy Rogers and sleeping on my couch and wow, playing with my kid's guinea pig. And I still have his hair pick here. Left it. I got a peace sign. It's racked in duct tape. And
that is awesome.
Yeah. So we kind of got to know those guys, and that was the mid-80s, and yeah, things were breaking open, and Lake Effect, the Petroff brothers became of age, and they started playing out, and there was Dr. Blue, and he was on the scene, and it was really that core group of bands that were gigging and playing out at that time. And later I had learned kind of the history of how they came up. And it really all goes back to Kelly James.
Yeah.
And Kelly was roommates with, lived next door to Mark Hoffman. and he turned Mark Hoffman on to the blues, and turned Nancy on to the blues, and she turned Kyle on to the blues.
Yeah.
And then Kyle turned Pete McMahon and the Petroff brothers and the Valley guys, all he turned them all on to the blues. And so it was really kind of, Kelly was the root of it all.
Yeah.
And with the Kelly was a great guy. He would always support and promote anybody that was interested in blues, and he came to more of my gigs than anybody, and he'd always come up afterward and tell me what he liked, and wow, man, I love that thing you're doing. Oh, man, it sounded just like Albert Collins, or it sounded just like, you know, mm-hmm. And he'd make you feel really good about what you were doing, that you were, yeah. You know, because he was the real deal, and if you could get it past him, well, then you were doing something. And if he liked it, you know, you figured you were on the right track. And so with the KJ scholarship that the Blues Fest has to help support the younger players that are coming up, I think it's fitting it's in KJ's name, because he was really, you know, one of the forefathers of the blues scene in Syracuse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was stuff that went on before that, before my time. I heard there was Captain Max. They used to have lots of blues, and that's where Kelly used to see it.
Okay.
And Gordy Canyon was the drummer for that band, and that was down on the Boulevard, and everybody used to go there to hear blues, and that was kind of in Cannon's Ballroom. And Kyle was promoting shows, and Kyle would bring through Muddy Waters, Freddie King, you name it. He had Stevie Ray Vaughan at a bar in North Salina Street, and two people showed up.
Wow.
You know, back in the day. I saw a festival that Kelly had done. It had Mississippi John Lee Hooker, had Buddy Guy, had John Lee Hooker, had, I mean, a list of 20 people. You wouldn't believe a one-day blues festival. Admission was $2.
Holy cow.
He had the poster on his wall left over from that.
That's awesome.
You know, that was
for my time. That's really great stuff to hear. It's incredible that all those legends came through the area, and it really makes sense that how inspiring to young musicians, and then probably very inspiring to the senior statesmen there as well, that there were young people that were so interested in what they were doing.
Yeah, it was, I remember we opened for Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, and all of a sudden Junior says, there's a local kid we want to pull up here on stage. And I'm like, local kid, who's that? And he pulls up this 13-year-old kid that I didn't even know, plays harmonica. It was Matt Tarbell.
Oh, nice. And
he was fresh out of rehab, I guess. And and the he had he knew Junior's stuff, to play the hell out of the harmonica, just blew us away. Kyle is related to Matt, and Kyle is really close with Junior Wells. They were friends back in Chicago. But that was Matt's first time I met Matt. He was 13 years old, and he was called up on stage by Junior Wells. He said, I want to call up my little buddy here, you know. And so there was a lot of interaction with the younger – you know, we were blessed back then, because blues hadn't really taken off yet. I had Gatemouth Brown play my wedding for less money than I played a wedding for. And he had to bring the bus up from Louisiana. It was, you know, back in that day, you could hire for, you know, $1,000, $1,500, just about any name out there, from James Cotton.
Yeah.
To name it, you know, except Albert King. He wanted 2,000, and he wouldn't budge. And I'd call him about once a month and try to, come on, whoa, I can't afford it. Cause I knew how much we were going to take into the door, and I knew, you know, how much I could afford. And it was a different scene. We were lucky back then. We had all the greats were still touring, and you could get out and see them, and it wasn't a lot of money, and you could see them in a small club, you know, years later, those guys were booked a year in advance, playing huge festivals, touring in Europe and everything else, you know, like they finally got their due, and it became harder and harder, you know, as a festival director to land those guys. But back in that day, it was easy. I mean, you could pick up the phone, and there was no contract. It was like, you know, hey, be here. And
yeah,
you know, it was Pine Top started playing and I was booking him. And his wife started, she was handling the booking, Karina. And you'd call her up. And I talked to her one time. She says, well, I've been talking to Remy Martin, so you might want to call back tomorrow and just remind me. But yeah, Pine Top's available, and I'll, you know, just send on in the deposit money. So I send the deposit money and sent her the dates and wrote them down and everything. And what I learned later was that Pine Top got the gig money and she got the deposit money. So she used to, Pine Top would become triple booked because she just kept saying, yeah, just send on in the deposit money. One time I had five shows. I had a double-decker paddle boat up in 1,000 Islands for any even. And I sold tickets, advertised in the New Times, posters up. And I found out he was triple booked. And I had to cancel, you know, all those shows. the real blue.
Before, you know, the internet.
Yeah, yeah. You know, at the time we had Pine Top in at the Orange Grove, it was sold out. There were 50 people waiting outside to get in. And we just had an incredible night. Colin ends up grabbing Pine Top and I and saying, hey, I know where this party is. Come on, you want to go party? And Pine Top at that time, he was pushing 70, had to be. And he's like, yeah, yeah, let's go party. You know, and he had this purple, like, velour, gorgeous suit on. And next thing you know, we're climbing this fire escape off of Westcott Street to get up to the third floor of this party that was up in the top apartment. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. Colin tells his story better than I do. But we got up there. I mean, 10 minutes later, Pine Top had this gorgeous little 19-year-old sitting on his lap. She was all thrilled. There was a blues legend.
Nice.
It was a lot of fun. And it was a great thing. The clubs were packed and we could play five nights a week back then. And everybody was discovering blues. We'd go into some bars and be a heavy metal bar. And, you know, they'd be, you know, we don't know about this. And they kind of look at us funny. And by the end of the night, they're buying us shots and they love blues and they want to know when they can have us back, you know.
Sure.
And it was a great thing. And I had great fun with it. And years later, they started a Blues Archive or Blues Connection magazine. And out of that grew the Blues Fest. And there were meetings there with Kim Ahern and Sue and Jimmy Murphy and Kyle. And see, first one, I remember Tom Townsley was there, Mike Petroff, I was there. And Jimmy was really grabbing the bull by the horns. I didn't see he and I getting along very well. So I kind of backed away from things as far as, you know, running the Blues Fest. I was there to support it any way I could. But Jimmy was the guy getting the ball rolling with the fest and through Blues Connection magazine. And it took off. It was a beautiful thing. It coming right out of the gate. The Jazz Fest had been downtown and they had an offer from the county to move it out to the county parks. And the mayor, Matt Driscoll, was upset about that and wanted to put a festival in its place back downtown because it was a big weekend for the downtown businesses. And he didn't want to lose that to a park. And I think Jamesville or Song Mountain or wherever. No, they had started Song. They ended up in Jamesville, I think, when they left the city. But you'd have to ask Frank. But that created an opportunity for the Blues Fest. And they got behind it and supported it and offered the DPW and the services in the downtown. And Pat Hogan was involved with that as well. And they were able to help get some grant money. And then Nancy Lorraine stepped in. And she was a state senator. She had a lot of influence. And she was able to help bring in some of the grant money. And it was just a lot of work and hustling and getting sponsors and getting the people there. That was easy.
Yeah.
It would pack and Clinton Square would be packed. It would be 7,000, 10,000 people. And it was a beautiful thing. I had a tough time. It took me 10 years to find blues. Nobody sat me down and said, here, listen to Freddie King, listen to Albert Collins, listen. If they had, my life had changed a lot, because I would have, musically, I would have gone that direction. And I just, it wasn't on the radio. I didn't know the right guy, you know, to turn me onto it. And so I got involved with Blues Fest because I felt it was important to turn people on to music. That it's one of American art forms that people aren't really familiar with. It underpins all our popular music, and it's good medicine. It's a great way for people to relieve stress and learn how to deal with their problems.
Sure.
And how to enjoy themselves when things aren't going well. And there's some great lessons in all that, you know, especially in these days that people need, you know. So somebody said to me, it stuck, best way to feed your own soul is to feed somebody else's. So, you know, that was kind of how I looked at it. And it fed my soul when I saw people discovering Anders Osborne, various artists, you know, that I knew and loved. I knew people I weren't familiar with. And so Blues Fest done a great thing at that to expose the music and keep it going.
Absolutely. So let me, as you mentioned this, it rolls right into my next question I had down here, which is, so, you know, people tuning into this who are new to blues or know something, but they want to know more, and it's kind of an overwhelming thing. They don't know where do I start? You know, because there's so much time and there's so much really out there. Give us a couple of recordings that you would, albums or tracks that you think are like must listen to's for people who are looking to learn about the blues. And then if there's anything that you think that it's just kind of like, anybody who's interested in it should really check out. So like, what do you mentioned Freddie King. What else do you think was some stuff that people should go to?
B.B. King Live at the Regal is one. I've bought 10 copies of that I've handed out to people over the years. And my little brother in particular, he said that changed his life.
Nice. I'm going to put some links up on this with this stuff later on too when we post it, so people can go and check it out on YouTube or whatever, you know, because sure. We definitely want to help spread the education on this. So
some of those Freddie King greatest hits albums. He put out so many records and variations, you know, with their compilations and things. But that early Freddie King stuff is, you know, that really hit me. That Muddy Waters' Heart Again, that's an
great album.
that's like the perfect mix between, you know, real deal blues with, you know, modern production and you know, audio quality, have you. I think a lot of people connect with that.
Yeah, the Johnny Winter and Winter Energy on that is just, explosive, you know, so.
Yeah. I met Johnny, I'd opened for him a couple times and was on his, I got kicked off his bus with Kyle one time. but probably couldn't tell that whole story here, but right before he died, I happened to sit next to him on an airplane. I was going down to New Orleans for the Jazz Fest, and he was playing down there. And he was sitting just across the aisle from me. So I was humming his songs the whole way there. You know, he kept smiling. I didn't want to bother him. I didn't talk to him, but, you know, I'm going to New Orleans. I've been to New Orleans. I sure had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
I remember that. So we were at the check that he'd gotten his luggage, and I was leaving. I walked over and put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, I hope you sure have a wonderful time. Just like he sang it in the song, you know.
Nice.
We were in New Orleans, you know. He grabbed my hand and gave me a squeeze and passed away shortly after that.
Wow. So.
Lucky.
He was a great, great stories here. I really liked that. And I think people are going to dig having some stuff to check out because sometimes with this kind of thing, I think there's a lot of mystery about the blues, and that's an awesome thing about it. But at the same time, I think sometimes it might be intimidating for people who don't really know what they're listening to, and they don't really, how to place it in cultural, context. And, Yeah. You know, and, you know, again, blues is something not to be overthought. You know, I mean, it really is a feeling music. So, you know, don't think about it too much, I think, is advice to people. But also, you know, this cultural story that it tells and how really it has almost been like a continuation of an oral tradition. And, you know, of the idea of these being passed from person to person and, you know, from stories of others and, you know, somebody teaching somebody this and taking them under their wing and mentorship and all this stuff is, you know, it goes back even when you read the stories of the like the electric players in the 40s and stuff. And they're talking about how they learned from the guys back on the plantation and, you know, in Mississippi, you know, and it was the country blues, and, you know, and then the stories, what few there is, but of those early guys, they were always doing the same thing, talking about, well, hey, I learned that from this guy. I learned that from this guy. That was one of my inspirations for calling this show Somebody's Blues because, you know, there's always that elusive thing. Oh, it was that guy. It was that guy. It was that guy. And then everybody's got somebody else who they were inspired by. And it just seems to go back endlessly. And then, which is a great thing about music is this, you know, this collective shareable thing. And people add stuff to it, but it's still everybody's gumbo pot, you know, and that they're dipping into and feeding their soul and helping feed their friends. And
chasing that tree down, I've spent some time on, and I'm kind of convinced it came down to Charlie Patton and Blind Lemon as the really the root. Here was Blind Lemon, he's blind, he's lived in the Houston area, and back in the 20s, and he's hitchhiking around, and T-Bone Walker teams up with him, and he becomes his sidekick and takes care of him and runs away from home. And T-Bone Walker learns everything from Blind Lemon, and T-Bone Walker is who inspired B.B. King, Gate Mouth, or Buddy Guy, or, you know, all that whole generation of guys, they all, you know, yes, them, T-Bone was the guy. Well, T-Bone got it from Blind Lemon, and then Charlie Patton in Mississippi, he was what's funny is he was Cherokee. He was half Cherokee and half, he wasn't black. He was,
I think he was Scots, Irish and Cherokee and some African. Yeah. I think he was a mix of a bunch, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And he played at Dockery's Farm.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, Robert Johnson and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and all those guys learned blues was their Dockery's.
Yeah.
And they had, on the weekends, they'd get paid and they'd, you know, they'd spend their money in the juke joints and, mm-hmm. And then Sonny Boy would get on the radio and had his 15 minute show every afternoon advertising King Biscuit Flour.
Yeah, nice.
And, the funny thing back then, that those guys copied each other. Like there was a Sonny Boy number one, and he had, everybody knew who he was, and so Sonny Boy would go around and say, yeah, I'm Sonny Boy, and they didn't know what he looked like. They just heard him on the records or the radios, and he knew how to play their songs, so he could go around and book himself as Sonny Boy. Well, Pine Top had done the same thing. There was Pine Top number one, and Pine Top's Boogie Woogie, and Pine Top Perkins got the record and learned how to play it, and he went around, and I'm Pine Top. And you can play that song.
Yeah.
And so that's, you find that there were all these little Walters running around back then, you know, because one guy get famous and they'd all grab his name and pretend they were him, you know?
Yeah.
And, but that was, James Cotton ran away from home and told Sonny Boy he was an orphan. He was 13 and started hanging out with Sonny Boy and learning, you know, blues from him. And you know, so there's been a from the early days of the blues, it's been something that's been handed down and something where you encouraged younger people. And it only takes those planting a seed, you know, just that exposure to it. And it can change somebody's life, you know, in a great way. Like it's changed our mind, yours and other blues fans, and people that really appreciate the music. So the Blues Fest is a great thing. It's free and it exposes people to that music
absolutely. And I think it's something that grows with people over time too, is that you know, certainly the challenges of life don't get less as we go through our lives, and so things that you know, that philosophy of taking what is hurting us and trying to process it or turn it into some sort of you know, joy for here and now, or lessons for here and now, is something that, you know, just only increases throughout our lives, I think. And whether you, yeah, you know, you learn it when you're young, or you jump in later on or whatever, you know, it's never too late. And it's something that I think sticks with people and becomes more and more a part of who they are as they yeah, age.
You learn how to laugh at your problems.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And when somebody else is standing next to you and they're laughing too, because they've got the same problems, there's sure, that connection that you, yeah, you find that a lot of people have felt the same way you did, you know?
You're, yeah, like, yeah, it's quite
worried about your woman or your job or your,
sure,
you know, it's real life. And
yeah. So, yeah. It's very different than the sort of vibe of what normal pop music is, where it's oftentimes, you know, I guess it lacks humility a lot of times, whatever pop music does, whatever, you know, and
yeah,
and the humility that blues has is that, yeah, I think that thing that is so charming about it and makes it identifiable for people. So let me ask you, is there anybody who's a current or, you know, up and coming newish artist, blues or blues influence that you're into or, you know, really liking?
A couple of young players, Taj coming up, and Jimmy begins with an R from Chicago kid. He's just coming up. He's about 19, 20 now. He's been wanting to play the Blues Fest and been reaching out over the years. I'm blanking on his name, but he is so good. And I keep seeing some younger players that are really impressive that are taking it new places, and Eric Gales is one who's just blown me away. I mean, he's the best musician on the planet.
Yeah.
He's got a mastery of the guitar like nobody's even come close to, in my opinion. And he's battling COVID, and last I knew he was coming through it okay, but for as far as the new stuff that I've come across, those are guys that have really stood out to me, and it's made me feel good that I can see there's a future. There's a kid in Buffalo that's really, really good, and I'm blanking on his name too. I didn't get much sleep last night.
You know, of course, with the Fest now, I mean, I'm sort of, the front row of what is new and happening, whatever. Agents are always sending me stuff, and, you know, and I do make it a point to listen to a lot of, crossover stuff and newer outlets where people are getting a lot of play. And I think there is a lot of encouraging stuff happening, not only just with, like, the electric guys, like with Gary Clark Jr. and stuff like that, but there's a batch of guys that are of younger players who are more into like the pre-war stuff, into the country blues kind of thing. And there's this guy, John Tavius Willis, who we've been talking to, and he's got a whole batch of friends that are into similar stuff. And it's really fun because it's neat to see people discovering their own culture or the culture of America, or just in general, this really valuable material of this old music or these old songs. A lot of it is just, you know, it really is timeless, and you know, and I don't know. Do you think that decades, generations from now, people are still going to be influenced by this music and still going to be hearing the echoes of it?
Yeah. Alexa, she doesn't know when to shut up. the Jemiah Rogers is his name, and he's a lot like Gary Clark. He reminds me of him, and he's got to be, 20 now, and he's as good as anybody. He's got so much talent. He's got a long career. He's from Chicago. He's got that real root sound, and guys like that, Taj and different ones that I hear, it's not going anywhere. And I remember Jim O'Neill from Living Blues one time, he had a quote, he talked about, he said, we don't have to save the blues. The blues isn't, ever going anywhere. It's always out there. It's always bubbling. It's always there when you need it. And it's been there a long time. And people that were concerned about the blues, its popularity seems to go through spikes. And with popular music, I've seen a trend where things went from folk music to rock music to more folkier music, and then disco, and then on the back end of the disco, the blues took off again.
Yeah.
You know? And then along came rap, you know, and it went down. And I've seen this curve that these waves of popularity for it that come and go. But I think underlying that's a core group of people that like roots music, that hear it and it connects with them, and they connect with it. And then they play it for their kids, and they're, you know, there's a lot of kids that grew up listening to it now that my son says, geez, I play this stuff. And my friend, oh my God, I've never heard of that before. To him, he's heard it his whole life. You know, every day he knows all the words. He was one of the lucky ones, you know, he was exposed to it. I think there's a strong undercurrent that's going to carry it, you know, well beyond. I don't think it'll ever go away. I think it'll always, in one form or another, it's going to be there. So, you know, with the internet, YouTube, and the kids having so much exposure and availability to, you know, I can mention Tampa Red, for example, and there's so many great, great blues artists that I still discover I look and they've got 20 albums. I'm like, okay, well, the next year I'm going to be discovering some guy from the 30s here I've been listening to the music for 30, 40 years, and I still haven't discovered, I'm still finding these new guys. And this stuff's on YouTube now, and the kids can find it, and they see it. It was, for me, the toughest part was, you know, I had to caddy, I had to save up. I got $15. I'm going, what album am I going to buy?
Yeah.
You know, sure. And I don't want to buy a bad one again. Right. And do I buy this blues record that some guy would never, but nowadays they just turn on YouTube and it's free. So there's a lot more exposure for the music in places and areas and kids. I think that's going to help, you know, continue.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm constantly, going through Spotify and YouTube and educating myself, learning more stuff. And it's just, it's never ending. And I was one of those kids as well, where it was like, the money for the records, whatever. It's like, there was always way, way more things that I wanted to buy than I could. And so I feel a bit spoiled and grateful that, you know, the age of technology now, where I can just kind of keep listening to more and more stuff and really enjoying all that past work. Well, cool. This has been great. Great stories, man. Anything, what have you been doing lately? You've been playing at all? I know it's everybody's locked in, whatever, but you been getting out at all or jamming at home? Or?
I quit playing, not this July, but the one before.
Yeah.
I was with Carolyn, and I'd been playing since I was 17, pretty much full time. It was like 38 years of gigs. And I just thought I'd take a little time off, but boy, did I enjoy not having to worry about having a freaking gig on the weekend. Yeah. And being able, I've been playing, I play all the time at home and recording and writing and my guitar plans. I've had the time to spend on expanding it, listening to new things. So I'm kind of having a musical renaissance, but it's all by myself. maybe one day I'll put it back on the road. I want to do a CD someday and then do some gigs around that. Musically, that's pretty much, I do acoustic gigs once in a blue moon here and there. It feels good to, you know, just get out and play miss it. And then I go sit in with folks, you know, I'll walk in, somebody will hand me a guitar, whether I like it or not. And I'm real happy, just doing that. And checking out music. I've got all this more time now to go see other people play.
And, yeah.
So I've been enjoying that. But yeah, not playing too much anymore right now.
Well, we really appreciate it. And like I said, maybe we'll all come out on the other side of this with all sorts of new things we've learned. And
maybe there'll be this great collection of music that comes out of this.
Yeah,
you know, there's got to be a good side.
Yeah, absolutely. We're gonna keep the faith on it. So I very much appreciate you taking some time with us today to chat about all this wonderful music. Thank you for all the great stories. This podcast has been brought to you by the New York State Blues Festival, one of the largest free blues events in the country. Please mark your calendars for June 24th through 26th, 2021 for our anticipated return to Clinton Square in downtown Syracuse. For all details and information, please visit our website at www.nysbluesfest.com. And thank you, Todd, and for everybody who's tuning in to the episode one of Somebody's Blues. Be good, dig the music, and spread the love. Peace. Thank you.